Good morning and welcome. My name is Amelia Maria de la Luz Montes. I am an associate professor of English and Ethnic Studies. It's really wonderful to see all of you here. Welcome to the 37th Interdisciplinary Symposium sponsored by the Center for Great Plains Studies here at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Today's symposium, Diverse Faces, Shared Histories, Immigrants on the Great Plains, features national and state scholars and writers speaking on various aspects regarding the history, politics, and personal narratives on immigration. Native, Asian, African American, Latina perspectives vary yet share overlapping histories. This symposium is designed to educate and broaden our perspectives about immigration on the Great Plains. As chair of this symposium, I wish to thank the following supporters and co-sponsors: the Nebraska Humanities Council, the Nebraska Cultural Endowment, the Department of Anthropology, the Department of English, the Creative Writing Program, the Environmental Studies Program, the Institute for Ethnic Studies, the International Studies Program, the Department of Modern Languages and Literatures, the Department of Political Science, the Department of Psychology, the Women's and Gender Studies Program, the Forsyth Family Program on Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs, the National Drought Mitigation Center, and the School of Natural Resources. This symposium has been a year in the making, and it has been such a pleasure working with the staff at the Center for Great Plains Studies. These are the people who work so hard behind the scenes to make this happen. I would like the following staff members to come up and receive a little gift. I hope they're around. These are gifts. These gifts are actually, they're lovely little coffee mugs from Indigo Bridge Books in the Haymarket. Indigo Bridge has also been quite active in discussions of immigration by organizing a film series on immigration, and there are flyers outside about Indigo Bridge books. Their last immigration documentary series film is In the Shadow of the Raid, and that is Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m. So thank you to the following staff members at the Center for Great Plains Studies. Without you, we would not be here. And I just saw Jim Stubendeck, director of the center. Jim, if you could come up, I'd like to give you a little present. Thank you for your guidance and support. He's always been there for us. And events coordinator and webmaster, Kim Weedy, if Kim could come up. Thank you so much. And publication specialist, Linda Ratcliffe. And all of you kept us moving this year. It was a smooth ride because of all of you. And we didn't get stopped by the migration, La Migra, we didn't. So I'd also like to thank Donna Woodenberg and Andrew Graybill, who attended so many of our meetings and are today's moderators. So if they could come up and get a mug as well. All these meetings have been great. I feel like we're a little family. Finally, I want to thank and introduce the Chancellor, who is here to give the opening remarks. I thank you for your presence, especially with jet lag as well, and your words regarding this most important topic of immigration. And Chancellor, you get a mug as well. So. So Harvey Perlman was named the 19th Chancellor of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln on April 1, 2001. He had served as interim Chancellor of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln since July 16, 2000. A former Dean of the University of Nebraska College of Law, between 1983 and 1998. Perlman has also served as interim senior vice chancellor for academic affairs at UNL between 1995 and 1996. A Nebraska native, Chancellor Perlman was raised in York and earned a Bachelor of Arts in History and a Juris Doctorate from the University of Nebraska. He joined the NU Law Faculty in 1967 after spending a year as a Bigelow Teaching Fellow at the University of Chicago Law School. He served on the University Law Faculty until 1974 when he joined the faculty at the University of Virginia Law School. He returned to Nebraska in 1983 when he accepted the deanship of the Nebraska Law College, a post he held until 1998 when he returned to the professorate. He has also served as a visiting professor at Florida State University College of Law, the University of Puget Sound School of Law, and the University of Iowa College of Law. His area of legal expertise lies in torts and intellectual property. He is a member of the Nebraska State and American Bar Associations and is a Life Fellow of the American Bar Association. Chancellor Perlman is co-author of Intellectual Property and Unfair Competition. It's in its fifth edition, and co-reporter of the American Law Institute's Restatement of Unfair Competition. He serves on the Council of the American Law Institute, a leading national law reform organization, and as one of Nebraska's commissioners of uniform state laws. And I am so grateful you are here, Chancellor Perlman.
Thank you, Amelia. It's always a little bit embarrassing, you know, when the introduction goes longer than their remarks. So I'll have to make something up. I often wonder what the purpose of a welcoming address is, and I think it's because it's to make sure that the people that come late don't miss anything important. I am very pleased that the university is sponsoring an event like this on a topic of such critical importance. Immigration. I don't think I can add anything to your thinking about the subject. It is obviously a subject that is inherently controversial. We are all immigrants in one form or another. Immigration has, in many instances, across history, been an event that has defined the people of a region or the character of a region. It is a positive in the sense that it is a way that one can attract and re-energize the levels of talent and perspective of a particular area. It has its downsides. It is always threatening to the existing cultures. There is no probably better evidence of that than in the Great Plains. So I think we ought not to be surprised that it is one that generates suspicion, hostility, thoughtlessness. One can only hope that events like this and a continuing dialogue will ultimately bring some rational thought to the subject matter. It is good that this is an interdisciplinary context because immigration, like so many of the topics that confront us, have so many different perspectives and can benefit so well from the views of different voices from different disciplines. I'm delighted to see so many departments that are engaged in this effort. I'm reminded I'm just back last night from Qatar, where there's a U.S. government effort to bring the folks from Middle Eastern countries together to talk about water resources. And it reminds me of how valuable it is to have a variety of different perspectives, which there certainly were, and how difficult it is to have a variety of perspectives try and address an important subject. So this conference is right where this university should be. I'm very pleased that you are all here, and I wish I could stay. I'm not sure I could stay awake long enough to to gain anything, but I also have got some other things to do. So I wish you the best. It sounds very exciting to me, and I hope you all have a good day. Thank you very much.
For this morning's program, we're going to have a little shift, and we're going to begin with Tom Gannon, then myself, then Nick, hopefully. I ask you to send out healing wishes to Nick's mom. He had to take her to the hospital this morning, so hopefully he'll be here in later on. So let's hope. Okay. I'm going to introduce Donna Woodenberg, who is this morning's moderator. Donna is a postdoctoral research associate with the National Drought Mitigation Center, which is housed within UNL's School of Natural Resources. She has a strong interest in meteorology and climatology, a strong interest in sociology, psychology, and anthropology, and a strong interest in disciplinary research. At the National Drought Mitigation Center, Donna assists in social, economic, and environmental drought impact-related research and contract work at local, state, national, and international levels. Currently, Donna teaches for both the Environmental Studies Program and the Women's and Gender Studies Program, and is developing and piloting online course modules on climate change education as part of a NASA grant. Donna is also involved in community education and outreach, particularly in the development of K-12 educational materials and in outreach materials and projects related to drought, Nebraska's water resources, and to climate, climate variability, and climate change at multiple levels. Donna.
Thank you, Amelia. And I'd like to extend my own welcome to everyone today. Thank you for being here on this gray day. What better way to spend a gray day than with friends and discussing things that are interesting, informative, thought-provoking, and also very timely and relevant, considering current events here in the state and also in the nation. As Amelia said, we will have a slight change in the order of the presentations during this morning's panel discussion. The way that we'll set it up here is I will introduce the panelists one at a time. Each panelist will have about a half an hour to speak, and after all of the panelists have completed their presentations, then we will open the floor for some questions and discussion. Okay, so hold your questions. If you have a question, jot it down so you don't forget by the time we get to the end here. Our first panelist this morning will be Dr. Tom Gannon. Associate Professor Tom Gannon, his book titled Skylark Meets Meadowlark, Reimagining the Birds in British Romantic and Contemporary Native American Literature, was published by University of Nebraska Press in 2009. He has also written articles, reviews, and poems that have been published in Walt Whitman Quarterly Review, the South Dakota Review, Prairie Schooner, Great Plains Quarterly, Literature Compass, and other journals. Professor Gannon received a PhD in English from the University of Iowa in 2003. He is an associate professor in English and Ethnic Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where in 2007 he received the College Distinguished Teaching Award. He grew up in South Dakota and is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Tribe, and he spent the third and fourth grade at an Indian boarding school on the Pine Ridge Reservation called Holy Rosary Mission. Please welcome Tom.
Thank you all for coming. I probably shouldn't be the one to go first, but I will. The talk is called Immigration as Cultural Imperialism, an Indian Boarding School Experience. The subtitles are The Peer Gynt Suite and the Seventh Cavalry Cafe. There's a hefty memorial stone among the U.S. Cavalry graves at the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. worn from the Montana weather and sternly archaic in its typography and its very discourse, the epitaph must be one of the earliest official markers to still grace his site. It reads, "To the officers and soldiers killed or who died of wounds received in action in the territory of Montana while clearing the district of the Yellowstone of hostile Indians." The place is no longer officially called the Custer Battlefield National Monument. There are now several headstones scattered along the hillsides marking the fall of several Lakota warriors. However, the many neat rows of cavalry white headstones in the main cemetery are the park's main most salient feature and the first and main attraction greeting the visitor upon entrance. The rest of the venue largely remains a relatively desolate rolling dry grass prairie that it was at the time of the famous battle or massacre of 1876. And so visitors to the site are still confronted with his tribute in stone, which continues to erase the crimes of colonial aggression and land theft by way of the final damning epithet, hostile Indians. But now, wouldn't you have been hostile too, given the situation? I'm reminded of seeing the crocodile hunter, Steve Irwin, on one of his TV episodes, jabbing at a poisonous snake with a stick and jawing in his rich Aussie accent, "When you poke them with a stick, they tend to get irritable and aggressive." That is, hostile. Even my 7-year-old daughter had the sense to exclaim as we watched the episode together, "Well, stop poking it then." After the 1890 massacre at Wounded Knee, a real massacre involving women and children, Black Elk, still one of the Oglala Lakota hostiles, was involved in a skirmish near Drexel Mission, about 4 miles north of Pine Ridge Agency. Raymond J. DeMalia glosses this as the later Holy Rosary Mission, where I went to school, as we'll see in the third and fourth grades. Black Elk says, pretty much in passing, but with a certain degree of pride, "There are many bullets in the mission yet. The metaphorical readings thereof are rampant indeed. It's so multivalent as a trope. For one thing, this talk is intended to put a few more bullet holes in that mission." Sorry, iPhone speakers suck. Of course, this particular Great Plains Center Symposium has been planned and put on in coordination with the Institute of Ethnic Studies, but I find myself needing to stand the symposium topic of immigration on its head a bit by going back 100 years, or 500 years. I think Chancellor Perlman already referred to this. There's even a little inside joke, you see, among us members of the Native American contingent of Ethnic Studies. I mean, every time the colloquium topic of immigration comes up, we say, "Well, we're again it." Of course, we're talking about a 500-year history and issue, not the contemporary one that most of us will be talking about today. But I think that the Great Plains Indian experience needs addressing in regards to this topic. Nonetheless, I can't count the times I've heard radio talk show callers proclaim during this current debate, "After all, aren't we all immigrants?" As usual, a whole lot of forgetting is going on with such statements. For the North American indigenous, immigration has been, by and large, that of Western colonization, spearheaded not only by the military forces of the Custers and Sheridans of the U.S. Army and Cavalry, but by their complicit confreres of religious proselytizing, the Christian missionaries. Together, they performed a two-fisted attack upon the Plains Indian tribes and must have seemed a very strange Janus-faced figure with a Winchester rifle in one hand and a King James Bible in the other. The brute force of avaricious land-grabbing conquest justified by ideological rationalizations and sanctimoniousness. Vine Deloria's joke in "Custer Died for Your Sins" retains its black sardonic humor to this day. It's been said of the missionaries that when they arrived, they had only the book and we had the land. Now we have the book and they have the land. It may be too facile to call this colonial strategy the old good cop, bad cop routine, in which the might makes right, theft of Indian homelands for gold, oil, cattle grazing, et al., was ameliorated by the missionaries' ostensibly positive offering of good Christian morality and civilization to the unsaved Indian heathen masses. A better analog might be Althusser's notion of the modern capitalist state's control of the workers via one, police and military force, the repressive state apparatuses, and two, the ideological state apparatuses, that is, the kinder and gentler forms of control and indoctrination epitomized in the educational system and institutionalized religion. In such a nation state, things run much more effectively when the ideological state apparatuses can smoothly do most of the work of socializing potentially unruly underclass into accepting their situation. So in the case of the so-called Indian problem, after the policy of assimilation replaced the original an ad hoc agenda of eradication and extinction via genocide, brute coercion alone was no longer a sufficient or even viable answer. Enter the Indian boarding school system. It'll become clear. So when we first arrived at the Catholic Indian boarding school, my brother and I, first and third graders, were assigned one locker in which we deposited a variety of care package style food items that our mother had left us, and for which, as prototypically stupid little boys, we either immediately lost the key or the locker number, I don't even remember which. Throughout the school year then, that inaccessible locker was a lacuna, a gap, that gnawed at my brain like a forgotten first memory. When the authorities finally opened the locker for us at year's end, the various food items had been ransacked by mice or rats, and copious rodent droppings had been left in their stead. A poor trade-off at last, much like the entire year had been. An age of innocence had been woefully exchanged for a bitter worldview of guilt and sin and low ethnic and cultural self-esteem. I knew that my life would be downhill from there. I'd grown up in North Rapid City, South Dakota, and when my Indian mom had to get a divorce from my hard-drinking Irish father, she pretty much had to take a year off from us kids, between restraining orders and actual flights and hidings from my crazy dad. So there we were, Timmy and me, at the Holy Rosary Mission just outside Pine Ridge. They subsequently changed the name to Red Cloud Indian School. And ostensibly, the name change is a good thing, a reinscription by the native, if you will. And I've heard nothing but good things from other educators about how progressive it is now. Cecilia Firethunder, the former tribal chairman of the Oglala, told me personally that it gave her the organizational turn of mind and intellectual rigor to succeed in her bureaucratic career choice. But let's look at the Red Cloud history webpage itself. In 1969, Holy Rosary Mission School officially changed its name to Red Cloud Indian School, both as a token of respect for the man whose work had made it possible to found the school, and as a part of the program of re-identification meant to demonstrate to the world that Red Cloud was not meant to be an organization of cultural imperialism. And it's interesting they know this term. But rather the product of a lasting bond formed between groups of two separate cultures, hoping to enhance the best parts of both and serve the people of the Pine Ridge Reservation. To this day, Red Cloud Indian School, Inc. looks forward towards a brighter future for the children of the Pine Ridge Reservation. The school's work towards achieving Chief Red Cloud's dream of a Lakota youth who are both able to walk equally in both worlds. Lakota people who are educated and able to do whatever they want on the reservation or off. Well, they ain't doing it in North Rapid, I'll tell you that. And who will choose to live in a good way, how do you define good, and strive to succeed, you know, it's always been the Lakota way, you know, success, wherever their path may take them. You know, such a clever discourse of power this is, pretending towards some equity, attempting to efface its very, very cultural imperialism. The words good and succeed connote especially, specifically Euro-American Christian ideals. And notice that they didn't name it Crazy Horse Indian School. That for that other Oglala Lakota, that off-the-res renegade who was still putting up a fight before the massacre at Wounded Knee, Red Cloud, as mighty of a warrior as he was as a young man, became an emblem in his later life as an assimilationist, even a collaborateur, if you will. Let's just say that the Jesuits weren't casual about their selection of Indian heroes. Yes, these were the Jesuits, the Black Robes. In many ways, the preeminent proselytizing order of Catholicism at the time. Their methods of brainwashing were physically imposing, psychologically comprehensive. To this day, I'm still a recovering Catholic par excellence, and that I still haven't recovered very well from those Jesuitical ways, as my wife ceaselessly reminds me. I just realized that I even still dress like them. But, of course, I just didn't realize that. I wrote it down. My students ask me sometimes, "Why do you wear black so often, Tom? Are you in mourning or what?" Yes, I say, I've been in mourning for years. I just can't remember for what. I called a previous talk on my Indian boarding school experience a Holocaust of the Mind, with ramifications of colonization of the mind, and even a nod to the Native anthology entitled Genocide of the Mind, but that's rather a tortured metaphor. The point of all these titles is that the Western colonization of the Native, short of a literal Holocaust, has nonetheless entailed a forceful internalization of the imperialist Weltanschauung, my favorite word, on the part of the colonized, to the point that the result has been a veritable near destruction of the indigenous culture and psyche. As evidence of this, my Indian mom was already Christianized, but also desperate enough to think that an Indian Catholic boarding school would be fine for my brother and me. Even my old French Indian Minicosia granny had been a practicing Catholic, in spite of suffering the slings and arrows of blatant, condescending racism in Fort Pierce, South Dakota. And I'm not even venturing here into the controversy of Black Elk's likely hybrid religious view. But this is what happens when a militarily dominant race claims that its God and worldview are superior. The problem, as I see it, is the theological development of the jealous monotheistic God of the one true way that developed in the Middle East 2 millennia ago, whose followers later perceived a need to convert the rest of the people on the planet to the universal truths of what was once a very specific ethnic sand tribe-based set of ceremonies and beliefs. Unfortunately for current geopolitics, two of these one true God religions are at each other's throats right now. In contrast, consider Native American culture's more usual religious pluralism and acceptance, to be able to place that statuette of the Virgin Mary right next to a corn goddess Kachina on one shelves of household gods without any cognitive dissonance, and to be unable to conceive that one's own culture-based and place-based religion is also therefore the best one for that other tribe on the other side of the mountain. When the Lakota kicked the Crow or the Pawnee onto another stretch of ground for more Lebensraum, they didn't automatically think, "Oh, by the way, now you must worship Wakantanka. Here's a book." They realized that a good religion only worked for a particular group of people whose ceremonial relations with the cosmos emerged from a particular place. And some Lakota missionaries have never been a problem. Why, after all, would a non-Lakota in his own right mind want to join the Lakota religion? Well, of course, and unfortunately, this has become something of a phenomenon in the last few decades, because many non-Lakota have found their own religions vacuous and unfulfilling, and because some Lakota have enlisted in what Vine Deloria has dubbed the New Age Medicine Man Circuit. Look at the internet. I want to rent that portable sweat lodge, by God. How much is it? To adopt the tone of a famous Native American book title, I tell you now, Holy Rosary Mission was on a mission of culture slaughter, of social genocide. By the mid-1960s, when I was there, sure, there were no doubt a good majority of Lakota parents who had already been successfully proselytized and who didn't think that raising their kids as Catholics was a laudable, who did think it was a laudable or at least necessary thing. But that didn't make it right. What they and their kids suffered was a monomaniacal erasure of anything indigenous, an onslaught upon the Lakota way of life and language. And again, it was brainwashing into a Western theology, which says that there is only one very human-like God, and that therefore the eagle, Wambli, and the bison, Tatanka, and the metal ark, Tashirnumpa, have no part in the deity, are no longer Wakan. And from my own eco point of view, that's frankly anathema. Just a few years ago, in 2007, Pope Benedict created a stir when he spoke about the Christianizing of the Americas. Outraged Indian leaders in Brazil said on Monday that they were offended by Pope Benedict's arrogant and disrespectful comments that the Roman Catholic Church had purified them, and a revival of their religions would be a backward step. Damn Indians. In a speech to Latin American and Caribbean bishops at the end of a visit to Brazil, the Pope said that the Church had not imposed itself on the indigenous people of the Americas. Indeed, the Indians had welcomed the arrival of European priests at the time of the conquest, as they were silently longing for Christianity, he said. What a name for a book, Silent Longing. It'd be a long wait. 9 days later, the Pope spoke again. Pope Benedict, under fire in Latin America for saying the Catholic Church had purified Indians, acknowledged on Wednesday that unjustifiable crimes were committed during the colonization of the Americas. But he stopped short of apologizing. These two news items pretty much speak for themselves, given the hypocrisy of the Pope's subsequent lack of apology. For among the unjustifiable crimes he admits to on the part of the conquistadores, etc., the hemispheric deicide performed by Christian proselytizing purifications was as great a crime as any, and more significant at last maybe than the material history of such episodes as Sand Creek and Wounded Knee. When Catholic missionaries arrived in the Dakotas in the late 19th century, they were even then perceived as exotic interlopers, as evident in the following description from that era. Catholics huddled together in the dark, shut off from the modern thought, cherishing dear but exploded theories and legends, reviving antiquated customs, and seeking to impose them upon laws as others, upon others, thus binding living men today in the cerements of the dead past. No, this wasn't some disgruntled old Lakota like Lame Deer or some free-thinking atheist like Nietzsche. No, this was a Episcopalian bishop, William Hobart Hare, one of the leading Protestant churchmen and missionaries of the late 19th century himself. He was later dubbed himself the Apostle of the Sioux. I mean, he was doing the same thing. John K. Laux's recent history of the Dakota Territory up to statehood makes much, in fact, of the importance of religion among the Dakota pioneers, although his main proof brings up the unpleasant realities of Christian sectarian intolerance. The friction between Catholics and Protestants demonstrates the passionate commitment to religion in Dakota Territory and in the rural Midwest in general, basically because they hated each other. Since he is obviously a political conservative himself, it isn't surprising that Laut pretty much ignores the presence of native peoples in the Dakotas and the untidy fact that the criminalization of traditional Lakota ceremonial practices like the sun dance was an even greater example of religious friction at work. Even when he speaks of an intermarriage, this author can't seem to imagine that my Irish dad would want to marry a French Lakota woman. Religious and ethnic differences in Dakota Territory affected social life and such basic rituals as marriage. Ethnic or religious intermarriage was discouraged. This ethnic and religious solidarity explains the origin of the old saw, holding that a mixed marriage in the Dakotas was a union of a Catholic and a Lutheran. Oh, but John, it got so much worse than that. The constant reminders of the original military brute force remain. You still can't get over Custer, really, here on the Great Plains. There's a town in the southern Black Hills called Custer, next to a state park called Custer State Park, and between them is a business whose cuisine is, I'm sure, to die for, the 7th Cavalry Cafe. And it's relatively new, I'm pretty sure. Oh, the full sign reads, Wheels West RV Park, 7th Cavalry Cafe, Custer Outdoor Rentals, bikes, canoes, kayaks, fishing gear. Yes, you can rent a kayak. My wife has coordinated a week-long Holocaust conference the last few summers up at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. The conference considers in combination the Holocaust experienced by both Jewish and Native American ethnicities. As alluded to, I gave a very different version of this talk 2 summers ago at that conference. Last summer, the main Native American spokesperson had to give his main presentation via Skype because he was in the Black Hills teaching another course. He said, as my wife relates, "Here I am in a town called Custer. It's as if I'm a Jew in Germany and the town is called Hitler. Do you think they'd be able to get away with that?" Maybe the analogy is a bit hyperbolic, but the truth is there. Beside the nearly completely victorious Christian churches on the Great Plains are these incredibly strident examples of Euro-American military conquest. The names of Colonel Custer, General Crook, et al. Infect many of the town and school names in South Dakota, and they're not going to change. The innumerable tourist traps laud the exploits of gold-lusting hooligans. At last, the rah-rah brainwashing is still going on. To reinforce this brainwashing, we attended Mass 7 days a week at Holy Rosary Mission. As a member of the choir, I learned to sing an ecclesiastical chant in the Phrygian mode, a still medieval-sounding minor key that haunts me to this day, and it's already haunting you. The words were, I won't sing them, "Lord, have mercy." The absence of a major or minor third here gives this particular snippet of melody an especially creepy alien sound. And before 1980s death metal, the Phrygian mode automatically evoked rope-cinctured monks in a European monastery of the Middle Ages. Then there's the irony of the words I was actually singing, "Lord, have mercy," which only struck me years later because I'm slow, as I pondered a church complicit in the butchering at Wounded Knee et al. How bloody merciful is that? Then there was dormitory life. Every few nights, the attending Jesuit brother would play a recording of Edvard Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite, highlighted, of course, by the tune "In the Hall of the Mountain King." Y'all know it if you don't know the name or not. I'm pretty sure that the melody was meant to replicate the terrors of hell and to keep all little Indian boys awake and fearfully conscious of their sins and thankfully conscious of the rewards of Christian salvation. This, too, frankly, epitomizes the scare tactics of a bogus alien metaphysics. But there was little room for protest. A good old Anglo-Saxon swear word on my part led to Sister Bonaventure feeding me a bar of soap. More to my main point, the same fate or worse awaited any boy who ventured to speak Lakota. Well, my younger brother was an even worse miscreant, a spawn from some lower level of Dante's Inferno, apparently. And so I saw him beaten incessantly by the brothers, by a paddle several inches thick. On one occasion, they struck his buttocks so hard that his head was propelled into the concrete wall several feet away. So guess what happened next? So we ran away, once my brother and me. If there's any common thread to Indian boarding school narratives, it's this: running away. Not from any consciousness of fleeing the tyranny of colonialist ideology. No, we're just tired of being physically and psychologically abused, beaten to a pulp. We're also too young and stupid to realize that home, Rapid City, was almost 100 miles away. We only got about 2 or 3 miles, I figure, through the semi-desert, cactus-ridden terrain before we gave up, laid down on the side of the highway for the Jesuit van to find us and take us back to another nice paddle beating, as you can well imagine. Make no mistake, a Holocaust happened here in our lands, and it continues here and elsewhere. So writes Dakota poet and scholar Elizabeth Cook Lynn in 2007, by the way. She continues, "Anti-Indianism is a concept in American Christian life, just as Islamophobia and anti-Semitism are concepts in Christian Europe." Cook Lynn sees its Western monomania for cultural and religious imperialism as still controlling U.S. foreign policy in a quite sinister way. You may know where I'm heading. "Perhaps it's all too simple," she says. "The unfortunate people called the terrorists of the 21st century in Baghdad have become what the savages of the northern plains were thought to be so long ago. Thus powerful and determined colonizers will win out." I'm not going to stray too far into Ward Churchill territory here, but it's pretty symptomatic that immediately after the events of 9/11, the U.S. administration immediately appealed to the old tried and true binary of civilization versus barbarism. You know, given the history of 19th century U.S. expansionism, there's a certain irony in the appellation of civilization here, the self-appellation. Ironic, too, was the too common sentiment that in the wake of 9/11, those against current administration policies were unfit Americans who should leave the country, who should go back to where they came from, quote unquote. As someone part Native American, that left me in something of a quandary. The immigrant descendants of the U.S. settler state still went out. Just last week, the North Dakota House of Representatives upheld its support of the state university's nickname, the Fighting Sioux. Even though the very name Sioux is an insulting misnomer and bad translation, and local Lakota and Dakota people have long been against it, well, by and large, the politics of assimilation is a weird deal. One Republican representative called the legislation a state identity bill. Huh? Your state's identity is based upon another people? An ethnicity you're pretty proud of having dumped into the ash heap of history? That's pretty pathetic. Another representative said with some glee or anger, I don't know, and when the Fighting Sioux take the ice, if that doesn't give you a thrill, then that's too bad. If you want to turn it into the Flying Chipmunks, that's your business. I don't. And neither do thousands and thousands of North Dakotans. It's our identity at stake. Please. Then there's the really bad marketing idea known as Crazy Horse Malt Liquor, which has been made by Tornell Brewing Company since 1992. Their incredibly bad taste of an indigenous name for fire water is compounded, not attenuated, by their apparent self-alleged ignorance. As an attorney for the Crazy Horse Estate and part of a lawsuit that resulted in an apology from Stroh's, explains that this is in 2001. Hornell didn't know Crazy Horse was a real person or that there were any Sioux Indians alive. What? Oh, I forgot to read that. What? Speaking of such contemporary minor examples of racist Indianism, in contrast to the grand historical crimes of conquest and land theft, Sherman Alexie may be exaggerating when he claims that it's the small things that hurt the most. Well, but it's just such continued small slaps in the native face that my narrative has involved, beyond the threats of metaphysical terror by the Jesuits towards one little boy. It's the very existence of, oh well, the 7th Cavalry Cafe. As a second-year, tenure-track PhD teaching here at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, I eagerly agreed when a non-native TA asked me to speak to his Native American Lit class. You'd see, they just read Standing Bear's experiences at Carlisle Indian School. He knew I'd attended a Latter-day version thereof, Holy Rosary Mission. He rightfully felt that some first-hand contemporary testimony might be a beneficial sequel to that assignment. But the night before, I had a strange premonitory dream. As I began my talk to the class, people in black robes entered the back of the room and promptly took over the class by showing an old film on an old-fashioned projector to futile and fading remonstrances from me. So I initiated my actual talk to the students by recounting this dream as a segue to the black robes, to the Jesuit priests and brothers of Holy Rosary Mission who ruled my life for 1 year in the mid-1960s. I was silent, however, about what I took as the ultimate import of the dream, that my own talk would likely be ruled unconsciously by my internalization of their dictates, that in some, they had still won. And the fact that one of the students in the front row was a Catholic nun actually bore this out. Frankly, it just scared the hell out of me. You know. But especially when she subsequently brought a formal complaint against me to my supervisors for my dastardly apostasy. What angered her most was probably my recounting of the game we played at Holy Rosary Mission called Heaven or Hell. We were hardly conscious of the sacrilege involved, but the game's implications were certainly against the best tenets of the papacy. To a soft dirt hill behind the cafeteria, we took our marbles. We asked a fine downward line on the dirt on the side of the hill, branching lines off in two directions. To the left, you went to hell. To the right, that's heaven. Thus, with each roll of marble, we periodically reinscribed our own definitions of predestination and our good works. I was never sure about what, you know. But playing mock St. Peter's in our own self-condemnations or self-ascensions. I recall Silko's great short story, The Man to Send Rain Clouds, in this context. There the local natives desire the Catholic priest's baptismal water for their own purposes, quote unquote. And I think, so did we want the Catholic Christian eschatology for our own child's game, a bone game or a hand game at last, in which true native trickster chance could come into play. That may be a reach. Final paragraph, thank you. I'm not saying that my year at Holy Rosary Mission was mere unmitigated torture. I mean, we had cornmeal mush for breakfast every day, and on Sundays, cornflakes. It was better than I probably would have gotten from my food stamp aided home life. And the sisters and brothers did foster my intellectual bent to the point that I'm probably one of the few third graders in history to have memorized all the U.S. presidents, all 50 state capitals, and I'm still thankful for this, all 50 state birds. My bird book's on sale out in the lobby. There was, however, my next white teacher's chore back in Rapid City the next year of making me stop saying Anna, and I think that took a good year. But yes, when I finally got the locker open at year's end, I was still looking into the dung-infested metaphor of my butchered psyche. Ouch, I didn't write that, did I? And I'm here to reassert with Black Elk that there are many bullets in the mission yet. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tom. That was fantastic. Have we heard from Nick yet? Yes? No? Oh, okay. Nick will not be able to make it this morning, unfortunately. So we will hear from second speaker, Amelia. And after that, we will open the floor for questions and discussion. And following that, we will adjourn for the morning session. Amelia? I'm not going to be able to say her name as beautifully as she can say her name, but I'm going to try. Amelia Maria de la Luz Montes, close enough? Okay. Is Associate Professor of English and the Director of the Institute for Ethnic Studies at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. She teaches 19th and 20th century literatures, specializing in Chicana and Latina literature and theory, LGBTQ literature, and creative writing. Professor Montez's most recent publication, the Penguin Classics edition of Ruiz de Burton's novel, Who Would Have Thought It?, was listed on the Latino Books Month list for May 2010 from the Association of American Publishers. A chapter from her creative book in progress, The Diabetes Chronicles, was recently published in the anthology, An Angle of Vision, Women Writers on Their Poor and Working Class Roots, published by the University of Michigan Press. Her other current writing projects include a book of short stories, While Pilar Tobilo Sleeps, and a critical book entitled Corazon y Tierra, Latinas Writing on the Great Plains and Midwest. She blogs at ameliamontes.com. That's all lowercase, no spaces. Please help me welcome Amelia Montes.
Good morning. I will be presenting four poems by Latinas, Brenda Cárdenas, Gabriela Lemons, and Kristen Naka. These writers have either grown up on the Great Plains or write from their observations of the Great Plains. These four Latinas who negotiate their North American Latina histories bring their observations, their struggles, as immigrants or daughters of immigrants, to the page. Their writing articulates a continual negotiation of cultural norms, heterogeneous discourses, issues regarding language and speech, and a search for meaning that at times leads to an indigenous mythology, sorry, Tom, but at other times a rejection of that mythology in order to present a more realistic understanding of one's shared history. Immigrants share connecting histories regarding language and culture. First, before I focus on these poems, I'd like to establish a rhetorical base from which to develop the themes and tropes in these writings. I begin with the mural you see there. This mural is known, it's a much larger piece, of course, and it's known as the Cacatzla mural from an archaeological site in the state of Tlaxcala, Mexico. I chose this mural for a number of reasons. First, the state of Tlaxcala lies in eastern Mexico, so I don't have a map of Mexico and the United States together or in front of you with Tlaxcala showing, and that's because usually world maps and world maps Tlaxcala is not very easy to find because it is one of the smallest states in Mexico. But if you had it there and you took a string and connected Tlaxcala with Lincoln, Nebraska, you would create one straight line up and down the Great Plains. Second, this Tlaxcala area was inhabited by Olmeca Xicalanca people much before Spanish colonization and even after colonization, in contrast to other areas of Mexico. Their indigenous territory, culture, and language remained mostly intact. Usually in mythologies, everything is related to the Aztecs, but this is the Olmeca Xicalanca people. This is important to know so as not to connect that mythology. This is Olmeca, AD 650 to 1100, and their people developed an alliance with Spanish colonizers in order to more effectively fight against the Aztecs who were oppressing them. Third, the etymology of the word Tlaxcala or Tlaxcalan is place of corn or maíz, a shared history. We share a history of corn, maíz, and also, if you notice the corn ears on the stalk in the mural, they're drawn as Olmeca faces with black marks. There have been archaeologists who have claimed that these markings are those of warriors. That's the usual mythological way to explain this. But more contemporary archaeologists and scholars see these marks as paying homage to, actually, the black fungus that sometimes grows on the ears of corn. These black marks then could be interpreted as huitlacoche, which is a delicacy in Mexico, but discarded here in North America where it is called corn smut. I didn't know that until I moved here. These fungal threads or blue-black spores on the corn feed off the corn plant. North American farmers destroy corn plants infected with this fungus, while in Mexico, huitlacoche, or corn smut, is sold for a higher price than the corn. The etymology for huitlacoche is excrement, or some sources translate the Nahuatl word to mean raven's excrement, a very prized delicacy in Mexican restaurants and homes. Crop scientists have found this, what you call smut here, not you, but you know. Crop scientists have found this smut huitlacoche to be packed with many health benefits. It contains high quantities of lysine, high levels of vitamins and proteins, and yet in the northern Great Plains, corn with this fungus is discarded. Even though of late, some chefs have tried to entice people in North America by calling it Mexican truffles. Let me try. Instead of fungus. You can buy this huitlacoche or raven's excrement at some Mexican grocery stores right here in Lincoln, Nebraska. I was very excited when I found that out. I've seen it at La Mexicana on P Street. So this mural then presents parallel and contrasting histories, imagined and real, and how an ancient Tlaxcalan way of eating corn, fungus threads and all, has found its way into grocery stores in present-day Lincoln, Nebraska. Now, for a moment, I am going to enlarge this notion of shared but distinct histories by focusing on German immigration and Latino immigration. Here in Lincoln, we have a museum, and maybe you've been there, Germans from Russia, and it is here where I take just a few minutes to illustrate a shared history that's also connected to the Huitlacoche. This is a map of 1872 Germans in Omaha. It illustrates German concentration, and so here you see right around there, that's Omaha, and the darker color means major concentration. So in 1872, there had been a very marked influx of Germans. Here you have a 1920 census and report. A number of immigrants, and mostly Germans, are identifying as coming from Russia. So, and the list goes on. There are pages and pages of census in Nebraska coming from Russia and of German immigrants. In 19th and early 20th century, Germans, Italians, Irish were some of the ethnic groups who suffered prejudice, much like Latinos today, and were shamed into forgetting their language and their heritage. In Nebraska, German communities flourished. There were the word kindergarten is still in our vocabulary, but few remember the history behind the word. In 1856, Margaret Mayer Schertz founded the first kindergarten or child's garden in Watertown, Wisconsin. Nebraska followed soon after with a number of kindergartens in order to preserve the German language and culture. These children's gardens of learning flourished until World War I, when German sentiment was at an all-time low. Kindergartens were either closed or were pressured to close if teachers continued to teach the German language and German cultural practices. The politics of the time pressured the kindergarten system to reformulate its curriculum in order to create a homogenized, normalized citizen. Here is a 1920 on the right New York Times article announcing a prohibition of compulsory study of German in the public schools by the American Defense Society, a nationalist political group founded in 1915. It advocated American intervention against Germany in World War I, while at home it advocated English only and a nationalist agenda in the classroom. Today we still have kindergartens, but they are far from their original curricular construction. By World War II, the German population of immigrants who had arrived at the turn of the century were fully actualized into a homogeneous citizenry. When I asked the descendants of these immigrants who are in my classes if they are familiar with their immigrant history, the culture of their homeland, if they know their German, their Italian, their Russian, Swedish, if they know their Czech language, more often than not, they do not know. Shared histories. The quotation next to the article is by Chicana cultural theorist and poet Gloria Anzaldúa. So you have 1920, 1987. Gloria Anzaldúa wrote these words to articulate a multilingual identity on various levels. In this short phrase, there are a number of rhetorical strategies she uses. First, she identifies language as a metaphor for homeland. Then she places homeland in the Midwest or the Great Plains, in the East, in order to make the case that Latino immigrants are not solely in the Southwest, and in order to complicate what it means to be Chicana and Chicano. Finally, she complicates language, homeland, by claiming that there are multiple languages due to region, class, gender, sexuality. What she is doing is resisting homogeneity and insisting on a heterogeneous, anti-nationalist Latinidad. More often than not, this quotation is ignored in Anzaldúa's writings, and instead, often critics focus on the trope of Aztlán with her writings. This passage resists that interpretation. Anzaldúa's words in 1987 were liberating to many Latina writers who began to experiment and include Spanish, Spanglish, Nahuatl-inflected words, various dialects of Spanish into their writing. And since 1987, Latina writers continue to do so. When languages blend and stay mixed in certain ways, they create whole new ways for people to express themselves. Grammars change rules. Fresh words appear that carry telltale signs of their parent languages. Old words pick up new meanings. Artists often want to rush into these circumstances to take advantage of the fresh creative opportunities that a still forming language permits, a live language. However, politicians, critics, and historians, some historians, often resist this situation and insist that serious literature is written in well-defined languages such as English or Spanish, but not a blend of both. So there's always a battle among the people who describe language as is versus the people who prescribe language as it should be when interlingualism is in effect. But even once such a blended language is established, it continues to carry much heritage and creativity. There is precedent for this in Europe. The Yiddish language was a blend of German, Hebrew, Slavic, and a smattering of other Central European tongues. It was spoken by many Jewish immigrants who came to the U.S. in the 1890s through the turn of the century. While it wasn't specific to any one European nation, it was once a common language among millions of people from Europe in over a dozen different countries. Its influence is still felt in American literature and popular culture. A digression here. Scientists have established that learning more than one language more fully develops the frontal lobe in the brain, which governs memory, learning, and reasoning. And actually, the latest findings show that individuals who know more than one language are more resistant to dementia and Alzheimer's. Ansel Dua describes a heterogeneous people, Chicanas and Latinas, who speak many languages and who may share a history of eating everything a corn crop yields, including the vitamin-packed lysine smut, the raven's excrement. So let's go to this. This actually just came out 2 days ago in the Lincoln Journal Star. They published this report on the population change in Nebraska's 10 largest cities. Fremont, as you can see, with a population of 26,397 people, has experienced a 12% rise in Latino residents. In total, the census report shows 3,149 Latinos living in Fremont, a very small number compared to the rest of the city. I choose to point out Fremont because, as you can guess, this is where LB 48, the Arizona-style immigration bill, originated. This legislation, as you probably know, would require police to determine whether an individual is an undocumented worker or not. Last summer, I visited a small Mayan community in another small town in Nebraska near Fremont. I think I would, for their protection, I'm not mentioning what small community. I think of one member of this community, and this is not her real name, Zafrina Lopez, who wants to learn English so she can go to college. Lopez, who is a licensed psychologist in Guatemala, is presently cutting meat in a meatpacking plant. Her psychology degrees are from Guatemala, yet they're worth nothing here. Lopez, who is Guatemalan and Mayan, speaks Spanish and Canjobal. She and her Mayan women's collective are working in the meatpacking plants and also working in agriculture and taking community classes in English. Many of these women were experienced political organizers in their home country and are using similar methods here to help each other survive, settle, and develop their skills to better their situation. Sabrina Lopez, for example, has organized a cell phone tree, organized the women, those who are documented, to speak at colleges in order to educate students and the neighboring communities about immigration. After the Nebraska and Colorado Internal Revenue Service raids in 2006 at the Swift and Company meatpacking plants, Lopez and her collective set out to tell the people what actually happened. 1,282 employees, most were documented workers, were kidnapped at gunpoint and held at a secret location. The charges included identity theft, therefore giving permission for the IRS to conduct the raids. Parents never returned from work to meet their children. Couples were separated, families fragmented. From those arrested, less than 150 people were charged. Lopez recounts to audiences how during that time families hid in the corn. They spent nights in the corn, whole families, almost daily in fear of the IRS. The same year the Swift and Company raids took place, Nebraska Senator Diana Schimek helped pass the DREAM Act, which allows undocumented children who have attended high school for 3 years and graduated to be eligible for in-state tuition at the college level. State Senator Charlie Jansen of Fremont, Nebraska, sought to repeal the law, but Jansen's bill was defeated this past February. Oklahoma, however, repealed their DREAM Act law in 2008. Last month, about the time that Utah repealed its law, last February 2010, University of Nebraska President J.B. Milliken and other Nebraska educators testified against repealing the DREAM Act. Milliken said, public policy such as this open the doors of higher education to those who need it most, and we think we need to create every opportunity we can for a better educated, more productive society in Nebraska. I wanted to give you a brief background to better understand how Latina poetry on the Great Plains reflects all of these events and all of these tropes that have affected immigrants on the Great Plains. Germans on the Great Plains were discouraged from preserving their language and culture. These Latina poets, who have also been discouraged, seek to embrace more than one language, more than one culture, and they also seek a hybridity of these multiple tensions within their writing. So, how do contemporary Latina writers negotiate their North American Latina histories? How do they bring their observations, their struggles as immigrants or daughters of immigrants to the page? Brenda Cárdenas was born in the Midwest, Milwaukee, and has spent time in Kansas. She helped found the Latina Writers Collective that is based in Kansas City. And with the collective, she has edited a number of poetry anthologies. In this poem, Cornflowers, she focuses on the interconnections between cultures. Cornflowers. She says, my hair smells like corn tortillas. I raise an eyebrow. After all those honeysuckle and papaya shampoos, I can't believe my scalp hasn't soaked up the scent of blossom or the perfume of rainfall. No, she's my mother, and she insists that even as a little girl, my whole bedroom breathed corn tortillas. Pressing nose to pillowcase, I search for masa, reach back before molcajete and plow to a dusky meadow, its bed of soil flecked with teosinte, ancestor grasses. Up through the dark follicles of my skull, covered in sun-cracked husks, push the black-brown silk strands, cocooning thirsty kernels. Maize sprouts into fields of thought, bearing hybrid rows of words that fall like teeth from the mouths of the dead. The beginning stanza sets up a construction of difference. Shampoo with the overwhelming corn maize that permeates her hair, scalp, her entire bedroom that breathed corn. In the second stanza, she infuses Spanish and Nahuatl with the English, masa, cornmeal, molcajete, mortar and pestle, and grasses she does not call short or long grass prairie grasses, but instead teosinte, the Nahuatl word for grass. And finally, in the third stanza, her head becomes like the cacaxla mural, the corn on the stalks, cocooning thirsty kernels, hybrid rows of words that fall like teeth from the mouths of the dead. It is a poem that begins with an immigrant's daughter's assimilated perspective and ends with the complexity of one's individual cultural history. So if we're going to talk about the grasses, it's important to put up the maps of the Great Plains grasses. This is all the way down to Texas. And actually, if we had Mexico, and I've been talking about cacatzla, the grasses would go further down to Mexico. and theirs more of the grassland ecoregions. If you could turn, and I don't, I have handouts. Do you have those handouts? Do you, no, you weren't given the handouts yet. So I'm sorry. I think we're, okay, yes. All right. You're going to, there are handouts, and I have the poems Kansas and Driving I-80 and another poem there for you. So I'm going to wait a second. Well, please enjoy the map behind me. Okay, so once you get the handouts, if you could go to the page that has the two poems entitled Kansas and Driving I-80 Nebraska. First of all, Gabriela Lemons is a daughter of migrant workers and grew up, she says, in a household where Spanish was spoken. She publishes in both English and Spanish. Kristen Naka lived in Nebraska for about 5 years and recently received her PhD in English from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln here. She is now an assistant professor at McAllister College in Minnesota. So both of these poems read together reflect either unfamiliar land, loss, and desire, which then cause tensions in that place or in that landscape, tensions of language, culture, sexuality. In her poem, Driving I-80 Nebraska, Naka writes, the earth is fraught with these tensions. This isn't part of the poem. I interviewed her about this poem, and Naka says, the earth is fraught with these tensions, language, culture, sexuality, and I wanted language that reflected it. There's a lot of silence in the landscape, in the prairie landscape, and also inside the truck she describes in the poem. The two characters in this poem are in separate worlds as far as the poem is concerned. So I'm going to read it for you. Driving I-80 Nebraska. A boy, bare-chested with a switch, beat back the plumes of the prairie grasses. Behind him, a train filed parallel over the plain land. The glass tranquilized any loud wounds. I rolled down the window and breezes needled the woolly ends of used up breath that had unspooled into the truck cabin. No hurry to tell the story as she drove. The boy went to seed in the rearview mirror. The tracks plummeted into a defunct ravine and the train followed down the hollow, or was the right word for it, chasm. And then I'm going to read Kansas. I know when they harvest winter wheat, when corn needs to be planted, and how close to God people think they are. But I don't know one multi-tongued Latino where I can buy pumpkin empanadas, dulce de leche, and de la rosa mazapan. Whether La Llorona roams in white or black in these parts and what creeks she frequents, I cannot remember how a wetback smells anymore. Soon after he crosses El Rio Grande, the vein of my roots meandering in hues of azul. Now, in Naka's poem, notice the realism in that poem. It does not point to an indigenous history or mythology, but simply captures a moment of tension on the plains. Gabriela Lemon's poem does the same, but using the trope of nostalgia and also indigenous historical background. Now, in the final poem on the back page, again, Brenda Cardenas, who wrote the cornflower poem, here in our language, she's bringing together all of these elements of the talk I have given you, the prejudice that immigrants face, and how they negotiate their identity in this struggle. And it's called Our Language. When I sigh, I am breathing you back out of me. Like smoke, you pause, then melt into air, the silent E of love, or H of hábito. Háblame, you say. Yet my next breath draws you in with the air, hissing past teeth, because I do not know where I want you or what awkward syntax I'll leave twisted in the whispering sheets. The hush of your hands reaches me from every shadow. You kiss the slats of skin open to the striped dawn of the window blind. You kiss these warm L's of light and depart. In the caesura between hours and days, weeks, I stroke watercolors. The blue sinks deep as the resonant pitch of your vocal cords, an anaphora of waves lapping to the shore until the paper is satiated. I am not. We work in English, make love in Spanish, and code switch past our indecision. On days filled with your absence, I think in sinalefas and trace you in the ring left by my morning coffee cup. If only I could touch the amber circles of your eyes, kiss your liquid pupils when they dilate enticed, then I'd be inside of you as you so easily fall into me. I'd feel the constriction of an X we cannot name, the multilingual moan of O's, tense Spanish vowels awaiting release, then the loose twirling of an R down our spines, down the soft sides of our arms, líquidas vibrantes of our blood. This is how I want you, at once within and without, like a breath, a sigh, a language. And so there's the trope of the prairie in these poems, the grasses, as well as the Platte, too, the rivers. Much has been written about the prejudice and violent history toward the Germans, Italians, Irish, African Americans, Native Americans, the list goes on. One would think that in the 21st century, such a hostile history would not repeat itself. But this is where we find ourselves in this historical moment. Latinas writing on the Great Plains reflect this ongoing struggle with painful but beautiful words. Thank you.
Thank you, Amelia.